ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Monday, the 23rd of March. I'm Melissa Clark in Canberra, coming to you from Ngunnawal country and acknowledging other custodians. Iran has threatened retaliatory attacks on energy facilities across the Middle East if the US President Donald Trump follows through on an ultimatum demanding the Strait of Hormuz be reopened. The threats could signal a fresh escalation of the war as both Israel and Iran step up their bombing campaigns. Nearly 200 people were injured in Israel over the weekend after two Iranian missiles hit residential areas near the country's nuclear facility. Correspondent Catherine Diss filed this report from Dimona in Israel's south.
Anna Azulai is clearing the broken glass and rubble at her home in Dimona. She was in the bomb shelter with her children when the missile landed nearby.
I thought it was the end of the world, that death has arrived. We saw the death in our eyes.
It was one of seven fired across the city in a 24-hour period, aimed here because it's close to the country's nuclear facilities and in retaliation to strikes on Iran's own in Natanz.
Do you feel safe living this close to Israel's nuclear facility?
I feel safe also when I'm living next to the nuclear plant. This has never been a source of fear for us or a threat. It's never bothered us because they also protect us.
While it's officially described as Israel's nuclear research center, it's an open secret. It's holding Israel's undeclared arsenal of nuclear weapons. Because of that, it's heavily protected. So it was a shock the strike got through Israel's air defenses. The Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has made a rare public appearance touring the bomb site and confirming to the ABC the nuclear reactor is safe.
Is the Dimona reactor safe?
Yes.
A rare acknowledgement by an Israeli official that the country does in fact have nuclear facilities. He's here to reassure the public Israel's still in control of its war with Iran and urging other countries to join.
When will the war end?
When will the war end? It'll end when we achieve our objectives, when we win. That's when it'll end.
His partner in the conflict, the US President Donald Trump, also ratcheting up the pressure, threatening to obliterate Tehran's power plants if the Strait of Hormuz isn't reopened within 48 hours. A day earlier, he was saying Washington was ready to wind down the conflict. Speaking on NBC, the US Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said America could comfortably fund the war without raising taxes.
Has the president changed his mind about winding down the war, as he said a day earlier, and instead plans to escalate?
I think he said he could wind the war down at any time he wants. And Kristen, this is the only language the Iranians understand.
Just to put a fine point on this, though, is the president in the process of winding down this war or escalating the conflict?
Again, they're not mutually exclusive. Sometimes you have to escalate to de-escalate.
Iran has warned of retaliatory attacks on regional infrastructure if the US President Donald Trump follows through on his ultimatum over the Strait of Hormuz. This is Catherine Diss in Dimona reporting for AM.
As Catherine mentioned, President Trump's 48-hour deadline has about 24 hours to go. I was joined a short time ago by the ABC's Americas editor, John Lyons, in Washington. John, what can we expect when this deadline arrives?
Well, Melissa, one thing we've learnt from the Trump presidency, particularly the first year of this second presidency, is that few people can predict his behaviour. But last year he threatened Iran that he would bomb them, and he did. He threatened the then Venezuelan president that he would take action, and he did. Donald Trump's clearly now the most powerful man in the world, and in the next 24 hours, he'll decide whether to dramatically escalate this war or to look for a way to de-escalate it. My sense is that Iran will not give up their control over the Strait of Hormuz. They see that as their major leverage in this war, and that therefore there is a chance that Donald Trump will go ahead with his threat and escalate.
So how important is this moment for President Trump?
Well, there comes a moment in the terms of most presidents that are history-making. This could be the most important decision that Donald Trump makes. This is, in a way, to Donald Trump, what the Cuban Missile Crisis was to John F. Kennedy in 1962. If Donald Trump decides to escalate, the world will feel the consequences, as the energy market may well collapse and Iran may well respond in kind. If he decides, though, to de-escalate, Iran will be left with a seriously degraded military, as it is now, but the war will begin to come to an end.
John Lyons in Washington there. The impact of the war in the Middle East and the higher fuel prices it's causing will reach almost every part of the economy. Australian businesses are having to assess not just the price of petrol and diesel, but resurgent inflation and a potential economic downturn. Bran Black is the Chief Executive of the Business Council of Australia. Bran Black, thanks for joining AM this morning.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
How prepared are Australian businesses to withstand another global economic shock, just a few years on from all of the COVID disruption?
Well, I think it's a good thing that you mention COVID because it reminds us that this is a supply chain issue and we need to be planning accordingly. That's what we're seeing right now. So we are seeing businesses and government work together to understand the different supply chain scenarios. And I do stress there are many supply chain scenarios. We're trying to work through and understand what they look like, but it's uncertain. We know that the war has an uncertain duration. We understand, of course, that the war has uncertain consequences. For us, for Australians, that means that the very best thing that business and government can do is work together, and that's what we're seeing happen right now.
Should Australian businesses be encouraging staff to work from home or limiting travel and other measures that will reduce the demand for fuel?
Well, what we've suggested is that wherever possible, if people can utilise public transport, that would be preferable. Of course, we understand there'll be instances in which that can't be done. But I do stress that if you can use public transport and if you can continue to come into the office as you'd ordinarily do, using your ordinary flexible working arrangements, if you can come into the office and continue to support small businesses, we'd certainly urge that.
You mentioned the complexity of the supply chain. We're seeing most immediately high fuel prices having a big impact on the transport sector, which flows through to freight costs and affects a lot of things down the chain. So who should bear the cost of higher fuel costs for truckies? Does that come down to the transporters, or should businesses help pay that? Should consumers, should government?
I think everybody is trying to keep costs down at the moment as much as possible. And that's because Of course, to state the obvious, people want to make sure that they remain as competitive as possible. But we are seeing that costs have increased, and that's due to the increased demand that we've seen across our economy. We also know that because of that demand, that's translated into increased distribution costs. And what we're seeing in Australia, I really stress, is entirely in line and consistent with what we're seeing play out in other overseas jurisdictions as well. In those circumstances, the best thing that we can do, and I really come back to that point that I made at the beginning, the best thing that we can do is have businesses and government work together to understand where the supply stresses are and to put in place mitigating steps. Now, we've already seen a fuel coordinator appointed to help do that. We know that the fuel companies can engage directly with smaller independent suppliers now. And that's one step that is useful in the context of trying to mitigate against broader demand challenges. But fuel isn't the only concern that we need to address. We know that there are other issues that may well come down the line in the context of trying to manage the outcomes as they roll on of this conflict. And we need to be working together to mitigate against those outcomes.
Now, the Business Council has been looking at the level of foreign investment in Australia. With your analysis showing Australia's competitiveness in attracting foreign capital is slipping, why is that?
Well, one point that I'd make right from the outset is that it's important to note here that the Treasurer made a really important note last week when he said that in these times of uncertainty, and of course, as we've just discussed, it is very uncertain at the moment, in these times of uncertainty, the best thing that we can do is try and back in Australia as a competitive destination, try and be more productive in relation to our own settings so that we can enhance the quality of life for all Australians in the long term. What our study shows is that Australia ranks presently 21 of the 42 countries that we assess. And what we're saying is that we do extremely well in some areas like trade, where we rank second. And that's come down to a concerted effort that governments have made. What we're also saying is that there is scope for us to improve, particularly in areas like regulation and taxation. And if we can put our shoulder to the wheel in those areas, as we have with trade, then we can climb the rankings. That's important not for the sake of just winning. It's important because it translates into investment that increases the quality of life for Australians on a day-to-day basis.
Bram Black, thanks very much for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Bram Black is the Chief Executive of the Business Council of Australia. Now, you don't need to look far to find an Australian frustrated with the rising cost of petrol. And for the transport and freight industry, the impact of the conflict in the Middle East on oil supply chains is being felt even harder, as we were just discussing with Bram Black. The Peak Transport Workers Union and the industry's employer body are calling for businesses using their services to cover the rising fuel costs. Here's political reporter Lexi Junowick.
Diesel is widely considered the lifeblood of Australia's transport industry, and at the moment, the cost of staying alive has doubled in some areas.
The price has been an extraordinary increase.
Gary Mann is the CEO of the Queensland Trucking Association.
The consumption rate for Australia is of a scale that I don't think a lot of people understand. When you look at the price increases for us, over the last fortnight, that's an additional $188 million in fuel price cost just for the Queensland road freight industry.
Transport Workers Union National Secretary Michael Caine says it's time for transport clients, including manufacturers and retailers, to absorb surging fuel costs. This Wednesday, an urgent Fair Work Commission conference will hear a joint application from the union and the Australian Road Transport Industrial Organisation.
Last year, the Albanese government put in place some new laws which allow the Fair Work Commission to make contract chain orders. We will be going to the Fair Work Commission to say that it is critical in this fuel crisis that those economic behemoths bear the brunt of ensuring that transport operators and transport workers, the fuel price spikes are paid for. That's going to be critical for safety. It's going to be critical for the integrity of transport supply chains, which, let's face it, are the backbone of our economy.
Michael Caine says Woolworths and Coles, along with rideshare operators Uber and Didi, have already put in place interim measures.
That accounts for a chunk of the industry, about 15% of it. But there's a massive remainder that needs to come on board if we're going to make sure that supply chains are good.
It's unclear at this stage whether the application will be met with any opposition. But Gary Mann, CEO of the Queensland Trucking Association, which is part of the Australian Road Transport Industrial Organisation, says the response from the major players to the fuel price hikes has been mixed.
We have some quite major clients around the country that are not cooperating about the fuel surcharge. We've got others who are being very cooperative and supportive and helping our people quite promptly.
As Iran continues to effectively blockade the Strait of Hormuz, Minister for Energy Chris Bowen has revealed six fuel shipments to Australia due after mid-April have been cancelled or deferred, but is reassured supply is secure.
Some of those have already been replaced by the importers and refiners with other sources.
Mr. Bowen says he's not currently considering invoking the National Liquid Fuel Emergency Act of 1984, which would give him the power to direct fuel supply and ration fuel.
It's never been invoked ever, not through the first two Gulf Wars, COVID. I wouldn't exercise those quite remarkable powers unless I had pretty strong advice that it was necessary in the circumstances.
Lexi Junowick with that report. Australians are anxious about the future, expecting a series of security issues to rattle the country over the next 5 years. That's the key finding of new research from the Australian National University, which captured the views of thousands of people. Here's Defence and National Security reporter Tom Lowry.
It's been a difficult decade or so for many Australians, from the Black Summer bushfires and the global pandemic that followed.
Tonight, fires surround Sydney. Three join north of the city to create a mega blaze.
Tonight, I want to talk to you about the global coronavirus.
To the nation's worst terror attack.
At approximately 6:47 this evening, two individuals began firing on families, a crowded group of families on Bondi Beach.
And a new war in the Middle East.
The United States and its partners have launched Operation Epic fury.
Iran continues to hold world oil prices hostage, effectively closing the Strait of Hormuz.
New data from the Australian National University's National Security College paints a somewhat gloomy picture. We're expecting more of the same in the 5 years ahead.
There seems to be a realistic appraisal by the population that we're living in this much more complex world where a whole lot of risks are converging.
Rory Medcalf is the college's head and led a team that captured the views of more than 20,000 Australians on the national security challenges they expect Australia could face in the coming 5 years. More than 4 in 5 see serious cyber attacks, major economic crises, or supply disruptions as likely to occur. More than 2/3 expect Australia to become involved in a military conflict overseas. And just under 1 in 2 expect a foreign military attack within Australia.
I think it's fair to say that most Australians expect multiple shocks within the next 5 years. And that really, I think, puts a burden on government and the policy community to ask the question, how prepared are we, how resilient are we as a nation to be able to deal with multiple shocks at the same time?
Australians aren't just worried about what might happen, they're worried about the country's preparedness to deal with those crises. Fewer than 1 in 5 Australians see the country as very or fully prepared to handle a range of major shocks. And most want more information from government about the threats the country faces, with just over half of Australians feeling the government shares too little. Rory Medcalf says people seem up for a clear, calm conversation on what might lie ahead.
Even on the question of wanting more information from government, people also recognise the need for that information to be communicated in ways that don't cause panic.
Rory Medcalf from the ANU's National Security College, ending that report from Tom Lowry. South Australia's Labor Party is celebrating an emphatic state election victory at the weekend. The Liberals were devastated and may have as few as 4 seats when counting is done. One Nation's success is being closely studied to see if the level of support will be replicated at the Farrer by-election to replace Susan Lee. Annie Guest reports.
While South Australia's Labor Premier, Peter Malinauskas, celebrated a resounding victory, he also acknowledged what is right now a rising force in Australian politics, One Nation.
Obviously, the Liberal vote collapsed. The One Nation vote surged and the Labor vote has remained steady.
One Nation's vote of at least 22% could translate to at least 2 upper house and 1 lower house seats. Leader Pauline Hanson declined an interview with AM, but she told Sky News she feels vindicated.
The media constantly want to say it's protest vote. You have no idea what the hell is happening in this country. There's a movement, there's an undercurrent, and it's people saying we've had a gutful.
South Australian Liberal veteran and former Howard Government Minister Alexander Downer believes the Liberals were not only beset by internal problems, but also the wave of right-wing populism sweeping the world. He says stabilising leadership and restoring the Liberal brand must be priorities at both state and federal levels.
The party that believes in free enterprise, the party that believes that families and individuals should be able to chart their own futures. And secondly, make sure they articulate clear positions and differentiate their positions from the Labor Party day in and day out.
Dr. Jill Shepherd is an associate professor in politics at ANU.
It's a huge shock to the Australian party system that we're getting minor parties with more votes than an established major party.
It comes just 7 weeks ahead of a by-election in the Victorian seat of Farrer to replace former Liberal leader Susan Lee.
These results show us that One Nation has a great capacity to win votes at the moment. But if Labor voters are unwilling to preference One Nation over the Liberal Party, then One Nation would have to be a long way ahead of the Liberals or the Nationals in order to win that seat.
And whether One Nation polls well in other general, state and federal elections is an open question. In 1998, One Nation terrified the major parties in Queensland when it won 23% of the vote, but all 11 members quit the party by late the following year. It's since had further controversies and some success, holding a handful of seats nationwide.
There is great potential for them to become more professional, to stay around a little bit longer and to not have another implosion as they have in the past. On the other hand, you know, history does predict the future. and they haven't shown yet an ability to stay the course and to stay disciplined.
Dr. Jill Shepherd from ANU, ending Annie Guest's report. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Melissa Clark.